Please join me in welcoming one of our own, very own HMS alums, Dr. Steven Bergman.
Thank you, and thank you to the brave class of 2009. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here celebrating this joyous day with the graduates, family, friends, and teachers. In these rough economic times, perhaps we should start with a prayer of thanksgiving. Let us give thanks that none of you are graduating from business school. Healthcare is a glorious profession. It's so broad that each of you will find a job. If you love people and hate rats and molecules, you can be a clinician. If you love rats and molecules and are not so hot with people, you can be a researcher. If neither, and you like travel to exotic places and helping millions of people, public health, or politics. And if, like me, you're a Jewish doctor who can't stand the sight of blood, well, there's always psychiatry. When my first novel, The House of God, the story of my medical internship, came out 30 years ago, it was viewed as a radical book, and I was not always welcome in gatherings such as this. When I told my buddies from the House of God that I was going to give the address here today, their responses were immediate and not supportive. The first was, they must be really hard up. We must really be in a depression. The second was, there must be some mistake. Are you sure they don't mean the commencement address at the Harvard liquor store on Mass Ave? And the third, which was from the guy you know as Eat My Dust Eddie in the House of God in the motorcycle jacket, his was the best, of course, as always. He said, oh my God, this is the end of civilization as we know it. Over the decades, the novel has become accepted, but even now, sometimes, it's not safe. Several years ago, I was at a potluck supper for our daughter Katie's class. Wandering around, I happened to see two women talking and realized they were doctors from the Beth Israel Hospital, my alma mater. I sat down and waited for an opportunity, and then said, you know, I may not be the most favorite person at the Beth Israel Hospital. And one of them, with venom, said, well, you can't be as bad as that guy that wrote that book. And there was this delicious moment. And I said, well, I am the guy that wrote that book. And she blushed deep red, and that was the last play date our daughter had with her daughter. So it's good to be here. Truly, it's like coming home. 36 years ago, I was in your shoes, graduating from Harvard Medical School. I was unprepared for the shock of internship and began writing The House of God as a catharsis to make sense of what seemed the worst year of my life. Some people say the novel is bitter. Well, it was rewritten 7 times to get the bitterness out. You should have seen the first draft. The first reaction to internship is terror. Here's our hero, Dr. Roy Bash, going to see his first patient. 42, bad heart disease, ICE needed a new IV. My hand shook and drops of sweat plopped onto the sterile field. I missed the vein and Zeiss yelped. The second time I went in slowly and Zeiss moaned and cried out, help, nurse, get me my nitroglycerin. Terrific, I thought, your first cardiac case and you're about to give him a heart attack. I'm having a heart attack, he says. Wonderful, call a doctor. Wait, you are a doctor now. Are you a real doctor or what? My nitro's fast. I put a tablet under his tongue. He told me to get lost. Crushed, I wished I could. Another intern, the runt, was having a hard time. This, too, is a true story. As he sat down to lunch, he took out a pill box, put a pill on his hamburger, and munched it down. When I asked what it was, he said, Valium, vitamin V. I've never been so nervous in my life. Does the Valium help? Makes me feel kind of sleepy, but I feel pretty unflappable. I'm writing orders for it for all my patients. What? You're putting all of them on Valium too? Why not, he said. They're all very nervous having me as their doctor. After the others had left, the run said he had a confession to make. It's about my third admission last night. In the middle of all this trouble with the yellow man, this guy comes into emergency and I couldn't handle it. I offered him $5 if he'd go home. He took it and left. The real hero of the House of God is a resident called the Fat Man, 300 pounds of pure genius from Brooklyn, New York. He shows the interns that the delivery of medical care is to buff the patient so they look good and then turf them somewhere else in the hospital, sure, making sure that they don't bounce back. And also to follow 13 invaluable laws of the House of God. I'll mention just a few. Law number 3, at a cardiac arrest, the first procedure is take your own pulse. Number 7, age plus BUN equals Lasix dose. This makes no scientific sense and it works every time. Write it down. 10, if you don't take a temperature, you can't find a fever. Think about it. 13, the delivery of medical care is to do as much nothing as possible. There's something wise about that law. The body has amazing healing properties. It's saying stay out of the way and let life heal. Use what the old docs used to call tincture of time. The only interns who got into trouble in the house were those who were too aggressive, who invaded the body mindlessly. And number four, the patient is the one with the disease. In the years since, I've reconsidered this. It can be seen as the doctor's disease, which goes, I, a doctor, am separate from and different than you, the patient. Treating patients like objects, that liver in room 4, was a symptom of our distress as interns. We felt unsupported and alone. And as Chuck, the African-American intern, puts it, how can we care for patients if nobody cares for us? Gradually, each intern finds a way to survive. Some use humor, some use sex, some drift into psychosis and sadism, mania and depression. Hyper Hooper sets a world record for the most organs hit with a single needle shot. Marriages and relationships go on the rocks. Looking back, what have I learned from the House of God? My generation came of age in the 60s. We grew up with the idea that if we saw an injustice and took action together, we could change things. We helped put the civil rights laws on the books, and we ended the Vietnam War. In the fall of 1969, our first year here at medical school, we refused to take the black bags and stethoscopes the drug companies were offering. In the spring of that year, 4 students were murdered by the Ohio State National Guard at Kent State for protesting the war, and all over the country, universities went out on strike. We at Harvard were just starting the kidney block and had to decide whether to join the strike. We called a class meeting in the amphitheater right over there. People stood up and said, if we go out on strike, we'll never learn the kidney. Others said, to hell with the kidney, let's go. We went. I never learned the kidney. In the House of God, it's a vaguely described organ, somewhere between the back of the neck and the back of the knee. So, in 1973, when we entered our internship, we were idealistic young doctors wanting to learn, dedicated to treating patients humanely. But soon we were asked to do things that we thought were inhumane. We were caught in a profound conflict between the received wisdom of the medical system and the call of the human heart. And so without thinking about it, we resisted. I have 4 suggestions on how to stay human in medicine. Number 1, stay connected. Isolation is deadly, connection heals. The hospitals we entered were large medical hierarchies. In these power over systems, someone always had power over you, and you had power over someone else. Under pressure, we interns got isolated. Not only did we get isolated from each other and our friends and our families, each of us got isolated from the authentic experience of the system itself. We started thinking we are crazy for thinking it is crazy. And isolation can mean death. Potts, one of the interns, in fact, commits suicide. In a power over system, the only threat to the dominant group, whether dominance is based on gender, race, ethnicity, class, sexual preference, the only threat to the dominant group is the quality of connection among the subordinate group. So one thing I hope you remember today as you go on is stick together. Many studies have shown the beneficial effects of good connection on caregivers and for caregivers and patients, on physical and mental health, alcohol and drug recovery, morbidity and mortality. Studies of newborn babies show that we come into the world with a primary desire for connection. And long-term studies suggest that the best predictor of our happiness is not Lipitor, it's the quality of our relationships, the quality of our relationships. When you're in a good relationship, you feel more yourself, not less. When you're in love, you feel your very best. So self-care is really relational care. As the fat man puts it, I make my patients feel like they're still part of life, part of some grand nutty scheme instead of alone with their diseases. With me, they still feel part of the human race. What he's saying is this: live your life. The purpose of life is to live. There's no other purpose than to live. And to live is to be related. We can't let anything get more important than living, not even medicine. Medicine is part of life, not vice versa. And part of living is asking for help. When you're in trouble, do not withdraw. The way to stay human is to move toward others. Lean into life, not away. America places a terribly high price on the individual. But happiness is not an individual matter. As Roy realized, what these patients wanted was what anyone wanted, a hand in their hand, a sense that their doctor could care. Number two, speak up. When we notice injustice or cruelties in the medical system, and believe me, you will, speak up. Speaking up is not necessary only to call attention to the wrongs of the system. Speaking up is essential for your survival as a human being. If you see something and say nothing, it will slowly tear you apart. But speaking up alone is dangerous. Stick together and speak up with others. Because others before you have spoken up, your on-call hours starting July 1st will be much more humane. And believe me, that matters a lot. Number three, learn empathy. I was with a group of second-year medical students, and I said that, and a guy raised his hand, and he said, well, we already learned empathy. What? Yeah, last year in interviewing. Empathy is when you repeat the last three words and nod your head. How do you learn empathy? By putting yourself in another person's shoes feelingly, by seeing in that tiresome old lady your mother, and in that cranky child your son, by living not just in the I or the we or the you, but the we. And when in your training you come across these golden ones, these teachers who live compassion, follow along behind like a duckling a mother duck. Realize that any good connection is mutual. The other person is getting just as much out of it as you are. One of the most encouraging developments in medicine is the increased number of women. In my class here, there were 10%. Now it's over 50. Women are valued for being the carriers of caring in our culture and bring particular qualities to being doctors: empathy, nurturance, emotion. which have often been seen as weaknesses. These are not weaknesses, but strengths. Women doctors need not mold themselves to the male model, but build on these power with relational strengths and carry them into traditional realms of medical care. Number four, learn your trade in the world. You have to be competent to be compassionate. But the patient is never only the patient. The patient is the spouse, the family, the friends, the community, the toxins, the climate, where the water comes from, and where the garbage goes. The patient is the world. And here's the good news. You graduates are totally awesome in one particular important way that my generation was not. You are citizens of the world. You have been everywhere, done everything. You are not isolated from nor suspicious of different people and cultures. You are with them, even if through tweets and Twitters, whatever they are. You are the hope of the planet, and I and your family and friends and teachers are so proud of you today, it brings tears to our eyes. But before you get cocky, here's the bad news. You're about to enter a disaster area called the healthcare industry. The system is broken. It's worse for doctors, worse for patients, and better only for the insurance industry. The issue is crystal clear. The for-profit health insurance industry spends 30% on administrative costs, over $300 billion a year. The government-run systems, Medicare and Veterans Administration, spend 3% a year. Coverage and satisfaction with for-profit is low. That for government systems is high. Why in the world should healthcare be for profit? Cost cutting. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Cost cutting is necessary, but there is no way, no way, that cost cutting can save enough money to support the profits of a for-profit system. The solution is just as clear. First, a universal coverage federal system. Anything less is just palliative, whistling past the graveyard of American healthcare. The for-profit system can continue for the wealthy. Second, tort reform so doctors are not ordering tests to guard against lawsuits. Third, in the SHEM system, paying for all medical education in return for service. This means forgiving all student loans starting retroactively from today. How to pay for it? Simple. We as a nation must change our priorities. A whole year's budget for the National Institute of Health is 2 days' budget for the Department of Defense. Isn't health care for all a higher priority than spending half of our tax dollars for what, in my whole lifetime, has been an endless progression of foreign wars? How do we get there from here? We are the workers. Has anyone ever heard in a crowded theater when someone collapses, is there an insurance executive in the house? We do the work. We have the power. Without us, there's no health care. If we stick together, we can take action and change things, perhaps by working with our elected representatives and our national organizations that have called for a federal system, such as the 16,000 Physicians for a National Health Program, the American Medical Student Association, and the California Nurses Association. But if all else fails, we may have to do what workers historically have done, organize doctors and other healthcare workers and plan to go on strike. So, stay connected, speak up, learn empathy, learn your trade in the world. One of the casualties of the healthcare mess is the shortage of primary care doctors. My new novel, The Spirit of the Place, is about primary care doctors in a small town, a young doctor joining an old doctor in practice. This was a dream of mine to go back to my hometown to practice. It didn't work out in life, so I did it in fiction. It shows the joys of primary care and the sorrows. As the old doctor puts it, the only person who knows what's going on around this town is me. People tell the truth in here. A fellow like me gets to lift up the lid, peek in under the edge, and see what's what. If the house of God is how to stay human in your training, this is how to stay human when you get out. As a doctor who is a person in the community, a doctor in the world. At one point, the young doctor is making a difficult personal decision and hears the words, "Don't spread more suffering around. Whatever you do, don't spread more suffering around." This is like primum non nocera. First of all, do no harm. But it goes further. It's saying do no harm in your life. This is the basic human story. We are all on the same journey. Every one of us will suffer. There's no way around it. The crucial question is not suffering, but how we move through it. If we isolate ourselves and try to gut it out, we will suffer more. If we move through the crucible of suffering with caring others, understanding will arise and awareness. As a doctor, a writer, a husband, a father, and a person, I believe in this power of good mutual connection to heal. I believe in this spirit, this redemption. We doctors are privileged. We are present in this basic human journey. We are there in the realness of the vital events in people's lives from birth to death. Medicine is caring, in the full sense, taking care of, being with the patient, even being with the life force itself. It's hard to care. We must use all our tools and skills to care. We'll try to care no matter what. And even trying to care sometimes is a hard thing to do. Not only caring for patients, but caring for others in our doctors' lives. Finally, that's the challenge, the thrill, and the joy in the house of God. To become aware that the pain and suffering of others is the same as our own. To become aware if we are ignorant of our neighbor's sorrow, we bring sorrow to our own door. And with that awareness, to take anger and spin it to compassion, to give solace, to heal. For at our best, we don't just doctor, we heal. Let me end with the fat man. On his last day in the house of God, Roy finds the fat man in a crowd of admirers, and to say goodbye, they retreat into the men's room and lock the door. The fat man is leaving for his gastrointestinal fellowship in Hollywood, doing what he calls the bowel run of the stars. The fat man was beaming. "Isn't this great? I love it. It's like being on Coney Island on the 4th of July. And tomorrow, bash, it's the stars. Fats, I figured out why you stay in medicine." "Terrific," he said. "Hit me while I'm hot. It's the only profession that's big enough for you." "Yeah, and you know what the damn thing is, Bash?" "What?" "It might not be, after all." We were interrupted by a banging on the door and the cries of the Fat Man fan club, and feeling rushed, I asked, "Really?" "Sure, but that's the game, isn't it?" "What is?" I asked, feeling that this wily fatso had outfoxed me again. "To find out," he said, "to see if it matches our dreams." Thank you. Congratulations and good luck.